The Second Amendment, which is the First Amendment after Thomas Carver got involved, basically divided the estate into two equal portions as opposed to equally between the kids. On May 16th of 2016, Mr. Carver commenced a declaratory judgment action against Kenny and Kelly McFarland, seeking the court's declaration that the execution of his new power of attorney, his new will, and the Second Amendment to his revocable trust were valid and enforceable.
Mr. Hickey, does that, you know, and I know the focus of that lawsuit, while Russell was alive, dealt with the power of attorney primarily. Do you believe that lawsuit also encompasses or still has anything live in that lawsuit that relates to the validity?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. That action is still pending before Judge Brown. We had a hearing on that within the last 30 days, I would guess. There's been a substitution of parties in that action, and Judge Brown has yet to make a ruling on some of the matters that have been brought in that, but it's currently still pending before the court.
And is there a request to dismiss that lawsuit?
There is, Your Honor.
All
That's
right.
correct. And that has not been ruled on as yet.
Okay.
On March 16th of 2017, Russell Carver passed away. On March 14th of 2018, McFarland's filed a petition pursuant to SDCL 21-22-9, asking the court to assume court supervision of the trust. Secondly, asking that the court determine that the 2012 trust governed the distribution of the estate. Thirdly, asking for a declaration of rights and obligations under the 2012 trust. And lastly, a determination that the Second, Third, and Fourth Amendments to the trust were the product of undue influence. There is expert testimony to support these claims. The court entered an order granting the petition and set the matter on for hearing for April 27th, of 2018. All of the Carter children and the stepchildren weren't included in the notices because that was the trust that we were asking the court to assume supervision of. Those were the beneficiaries, and at least as we understood the statute, we were required to give notice.
How should we think about trust supervision, Mr. Hickey? How should we view that as a remedy? Is it an effort to marshal the trial court's equitable power to ensure fidelity to a trust instrument, to public policy? What is trust supervision in your mind?
Well, I believe that the court in Winterstein discussed what that was, and basically you talked about administration kinds of things. However, the statute that you relying upon also has another section that says it also concerns any issues of equity that pre-existed. And so I think it's broader than what this court suggested in Winterstein.
I'm not really even talking about any particular statute. I'm just thinking about the whole chapter and the remedy and why we have it. And I'm not saying it's even going to necessarily matter a lot to the way I view the case. I'm just trying to figure out what it is.
Well, I believe it should be. I believe it includes all aspects of a will, of a trust, excuse me. Mm-hmm. I believe it talks about not only the administration, but ultimately if you do it the right way, I believe it also talks about the determination of the validity of the will.
Would you agree with me that it's focused upon equitable powers of the court?
I do. I believe that's...
What if there's a legal claim that arises within a purported trust supervision, the kind of equitable claim that might, under ordinary circumstances, be triable to a jury? What happens then?
Well, I believe it's an equitable matter. I think a jury could be impaneled by the presiding judge or the supervising judge to determine or at least give advice concerning those equitable matters.
Okay.
Do you see any, is there any distinction between a proceeding to administer and determine matters relevant to a trust as opposed to a will, the probate of a will. Are those essentially synonymous?
I believe there are differences between, you know, the obvious difference is a will, you have 3 years, a trust administration.
Aside from the time frame. But the actual process, aren't they similar?
I would agree with that. The gathering of assets, the determination of the validity of the will or the determination of the validity of a trust, I think there are similarities, absolutely. Yep, I would agree.
And then you had also talked about the process that your clients employed to start this trust administration proceeding and the notice that was sent out.
Yes.
What, if any, effect does the failure to include Edwin on the notice have in this
proceeding?
That's
a great point. As I read the requirement, basically it requires that we notice the people under the trust that we're asking supervision for. I want the court to understand very clearly, we did not know, we did not have a copy of the Third or Fourth Amendment as to determine who was or was not a trustee or a fiduciary under those amendments. The only document that we ever saw was the Second Amendment, which basically altered it made Mr. Jenkins the trustee under the Second Amendment. But we were asking for the termination or court supervision of the First Amendment and the original will. And that's the issue. That's one of the problems that you have when you've got competing documents. Is somehow, some way, there has to be a mechanism to determine. Okay, is it the first amendment? Is it the Second Amendment? Is it the Third Amendment? Is the Fourth Amendment? And that's the dilemma that we faced, coming up against the first a year within after Mr. Carver died under because of this 5457.
When did your clients receive notice of the Third and Fourth Amendment?
When they filed their objection on April 19th after we filed our petition. That's the first time we became aware that Kelly and all of her siblings had been disinherited.
Okay.
Under ordinary circumstances, a trust supervision proceeding is viewed as a civil action. And the rules of civil procedure apply unless they're inconsistent with the provisions of Chapter 2122. What's inconsistent about Chapter 2122 and the rules of civil procedure that would require commencement by service of a summons?
Okay, the inconsistency is under 2122-6, 2122-9, and 2122-13, it's the filing of the petition that commences the action.
It doesn't say that, though. In 9, for instance, which is the statute that you relied upon for non-court trust, it says upon filing a petition being filed, and I don't mean to quarrel with you, I'm just visiting. Upon the petition being filed, the court sets a time and place for a hearing, and then there's some notice provisions in other places of the chapter. It doesn't say commence.
Well, you have to look at the because there's no statutory definition of commence in the trust and administration statute. You have to use the plain ordinary language of the word commenced, which is to begin.
But that's not what 31 says. 31 says apply the rules of civil procedure unless they're inconsistent. So I don't know that we are writing on a blank slate as far as what the meaning of commencement is.
Okay. The only it says they follow the rules to the extent that they're inconsistent or in conflict.
And that's my question. What's inconsistent?
The commencement of an action, because Judge Gazinski basically held that you actually had to serve a summons and complaint
in order to pursue a
a contest of validity. Okay. In this court in Winterstein, footnote 8, footnote 1, said you can combine in your petition a claim for a trust to contest the validity of a trust.
Which really just begs my original question, which is what about, let's say, 2122-9 says that the filing equals commencement? What is there about that?
It's common. I think it's just the word commence, Your Honor.
It doesn't say commence. It says file. The sixth statute says commence for court trusts.
It says It says 21-22-18 says that the statute provides that the notice previous provided by 21-22-17 shall be served upon fiduciaries, beneficiaries, and otherwise record personally by mail postage prepaid, right?
That would be one thing. I guess so is your argument that mailing is the service that commences it?
According to that statute, according to trust administration, yes.
That wouldn't be helpful because your affidavit of mailing in this case is April 2nd, so that's after the 1 year would have expired. Or am I missing something on that?
It's part of the whole process. I mean, if this court in Winterstein had said you've got to commence the proceeding by a petition and mail before the deadline, that would have been. We could have done that. I mean, we read Winterstein.
Well, the issue wasn't presented in Winterstein in terms of timeliness of the petition itself. It was everyone knew that was well beyond the 1 year mark
because she waited too long. But we actually, in our view, we actually began the proceeding
by filing. What in the text of 21-22-9, the statute that you used, or anywhere else in that chapter, says that filing equals commencement?
There's nothing that says that specifically, Your Honor.
We have instances, don't we, sometimes, where someone might file. We have an action that's been filed but not commenced because there hasn't been service. We still might schedule a hearing for something on the off chance we might get service between now and the hearing.
Well, the statute, as I can't quote it exactly, the statute says the court shall set a hearing. The court and that's mandatory language.
But what about setting a hearing means that it's commenced?
After the hearing, the court the language says at the hearing the court shall assume jurisdiction and proceed accordingly unless otherwise good cause is shown, as I remember. That's the process that we started, Your Honor. Okay. And like I said, Judge Gazinski held that because of the word action, because title in 31 it talks about the action, he held that required a summons and a complaint. But the rest of that language says unless it's inconsistent or in conflict with 22-21, and we submit it is that language is inconsistent because it talks about a
what
filing.
Language? That's what I'm trying to get drive at. What language? What text?
The language of filing a petition. It doesn't say serve a summons and complaint. It says you file a petition.
Okay.
It says that in 6. It says it in 9. It says it in 13. And all of those things, that's inconsistent and in conflict with the provisions of Title 6, which require a summons and complaint. And the wording, as I understand it, and I believe, the wording of 21-22 trumps any language, any inconsistent language in Title 6. And I think that's very clear that was the purpose of that coordination.
I want to go back to your petition, Mr. Hickey. One of the claims is for trust validity, which is petitioners asked to have the 2012 amendment to be determined to be valid. Then there's the next claim is declaratory judgment under 21-24. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between those two claims?
I don't think there is much, Your Honor. I think that basically we included the declaration just to ensure that the court had the authority to interpret the trust and the First Amendment to the trust, and I believe that's proper. At least as I read the joinder statutes under the rules of civil procedure, that language is not inconsistent with anything found in 21-22.
So the fact that it's a declaratory judgment claim in the petition doesn't modify the obligation in terms of filing a summons and complaint within the trust supervision?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think we have the right to make that joinder under the rules of civil procedure, again, in the absence of specific language in the trust administration statutes. I guess, you know, I'm going to run out of time here pretty quickly, so I'm going to kind of skip to the heart of the matter, I guess, if you will. The court, in its request for supplemental briefing, asked us to talk about the reference to cross-references, if you recall. And I believe that in our brief, we clearly indicated that SCCL 2-14-9 basically provides that cross-references, titles, et cetera, are no part of the statute. If you read Judge Gazinski's decision, that was one of the rationale that he had as to why there needed to be a summons and complaint, because there was a cross-reference under 2122-31. The other thing that I just want to touch base on is that as we read Winterstein and footnote 8 and footnote number 1, it appeared clear to us that we should continue or to file the claim for a trust administration, as well as asking for a determination of the validity, because the language says if you're seeking, that's the word that's used, seeking trust administration, you can include a claim for to contest the validity. It doesn't say, I mean, that I think that supports our argument, Your Honor, that it's the process that you start, because that's when you're seeking those kinds of things. And so I believe that language is consistent with what we're interpreting or how we're interpreting the interplay between 15.6 and Chapter 21.22. In this case, Judge Gazinski basically concluded that the word action, that Title 15, the word action, basically changes the way in which trust administration is handled, the way in which you seek the question the validity of a trust and everything like that. This is just ripe, Your Honor, for bad actors, because you've got a situation where you've got a statute of repose for 1 year. There is no requirement that any kind of notice be given to anybody. And Kelly McFarland has 4 siblings who never had a clue that they had been disinherited until after the 1 year. And that's the problem that, I know that that's not this court's problem, but that's a problem, because all it encourages is bad action. Because if I were a bad actor and I got a trust under undue influence, I wait 1 year and a day and I'm bulletproof. I don't think that's the purpose behind this statute, and I don't think this court should condone that kind of activity.
And you're indicating that your clients didn't receive that notice of the second, or at least the third and fourth.
Right, until after the year had expired.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hickey.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Billion, you have 20 minutes, and I see the clock's not working, so.
Good morning, Your Honors. And for the record, my name is Tim Billion from Robbins Kaplan on behalf of the successor trustee and appellee Edwin Jenkins. 2 settled principles apply to this case. The first is that STCL 55-457 creates a statute of repose that was created by the legislature to facilitate the timely and efficient management of trusts by requiring that any challenge be brought within 1 year at the latest. And no one in the case disputes the application of this statute or this principle. The second is that in South Dakota, actions are not commenced by filing. They're commenced by service. The circuit court properly and thoughtfully applied these principles, which compel the conclusion that the McFarland's petition in this case was not timely or properly commenced.
Mr. Billion, so when you say in South Dakota, actions are commenced by service of summons, 55-457 doesn't contain the word action, however, does it?
It does not. It refers to a judicial proceeding. That's correct.
And in there are other types of judicial proceedings throughout our code that are not required to be commenced by service of summons, aren't there?
That's correct. And I also think, Your Honor, that judicial proceeding could be even broader than actions necessarily in a court. For example, I know that some trusts contain language requiring disputes to be arbitrated. So I think judicial proceeding is a broad term, and that's the term that's used in 55-457.
And a proceeding brought under 2122 is not required to be commenced by service of summons, is it?
I think it is, and I think that's because Section 2122.31 specifically says that it is an action for purposes of the rules of civil procedure. And the rules of civil procedure, in turn, say that an action is commenced by service, not by filing.
But then we look at the actual provisions that talk about how you begin and institute an action under 2122. And is there anywhere in any of those provisions that refer to service of a summons?
No, I don't believe there's anything in 2122 that refers to service of a summons. However, that's setting aside the reference in 2122.31 that says this is an action for purposes of the rules of civil procedure. And I believe that is, our position is that's a clear statement that unless it is directly contradicted or somehow inconsistent, then you have to apply the rules of civil procedure.
So 31 then refers back to inconsistency and then being controlled by Title 55, correct? So at the end of that, it says if the conflict between 15.6 and Title 55 exists, then the provisions of Title 55 control?
Correct.
So under 55, our relevant statute here, 55-457, there are a number of different types of proceedings that are referenced under 57A that start the clock running or that by which timeliness is measured, aren't there?
Right, yes. There are a number of circumstances in which the statute of repose can be shortened.
So we're talking one of them, for example, subsection 5 states, and it's the may not be commenced later than the first to occur. Subsection 5 is the last date a petition for review of a will could be filed under South Dakota law.
Right.
So that's one of the provisions that we could look to in scenarios under 55-457 as to when a trust challenge could be brought.
Well, I think because the statute says the first to occur, would be the one-year deadline. Well,
and I'm not talking about this case. I agree. This provision wouldn't be applicable. But I'm talking in a broader sense. One of the time frames referenced there is the last date a petition for a review of a will could be filed.
That's correct. Right? Yes, that's one of the other periods.
And so under the Uniform Probate Code, when you file a petition for the probate of a will, which could include a trust challenge, that is done by filing such a petition with the court, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure that I want to take a firm position on that, to be candid, Your Honor. I would have to look more closely at those statutes.
I'll represent to you there is a statute there that says it is commenced by the filing of a petition under the Uniform Probate Code. So I'm wondering, what is the difference between a will challenge and a trust challenge?
I think the difference I would point to, Your Honor, is the reference in our trust statute in 2122.31 that says this is a civil action. And so with that reference, it imports the rules of civil procedure. And the rules of civil procedure themselves require service. And the point behind that is notice to the opposing parties, formal legal notice that a claim has been commenced.
Do you have an objection to the argument that Mr. Hickey makes that he or anyone who wants to petition for trust supervision can choose to do so and initiate a legal proceeding under the provisions of 55-457 within trust supervision? So in other words, as I understand his argument, he's saying our legal proceeding is an action under 2122. Any problem with that?
I agree that it is an action. Yeah.
Because that's how you get to the rules of civil procedure.
Right.
So in this instance, then, the legal proceeding of 55-457 and the action, One and the same.
Are the same thing. That's correct.
That's your argument.
Yes. Okay. And I don't quarrel with the idea that you can bring claims together in the same document, but that doesn't mean that you get to change the rules for one of the two claims. To me, it's similar to a situation where you would have a claim with a 2-year statute of limitations and a claim with a 3-year statute of limitations. You can't bring them both within the 3-year statute of limitations. So even though you can file a trust, an administrative proceeding at any point in time, you still have to commence, if you're going to challenge the validity of a trust, you still have to commence that within the time set by the statute 55457.
Mr. Billion, I noticed in your brief you cited, and this was in the supplemental brief, in which we asked counsel to address further statutory references and such, and you stated that the purpose of service is twofold. And one is to advise that a legal proceeding has been commenced, and two, to warn the interested parties that they need to appear and respond. So first, you know, if it's twofold, one is to advise that a legal proceeding has been commenced. Sounds to me like almost a concession that a proceeding has been commenced.
Well,
perhaps you didn't mean it that way, but please explain that.
That would be correct. We wouldn't have meant to say that a proceeding is commenced by filing, because again, I think our statutes are clear that filing actually does not commence a civil action. The service is what commences it.
Well, it's not the case for probates. That specifically says it's been commenced in a statute, so you can't make that broadly as to all a statement as to all types of proceedings, can you?
Well, I think for things that are considered civil actions to which the rules of civil procedure apply, unless they are specifically, if there's a specific exception, then I think the specific exception takes priority over the rules of civil procedure. But I think as Justice Salter's questions got at, there's nothing inconsistent in Chapter 2122 with requiring that a trust challenge be commenced by service of process.
And then with regard to the second part of your statement in your brief, the other function is to warn interested parties to appear and respond. So in this case, we don't have that issue, do we? I mean, everyone was aware that this was happening and, in fact, did appear and respond.
Actually, Your Honor, I think that's one of the key points that gets lost here. The point is that at the end of the 1-year statute of repose, neither Mr. Jenkins nor any of the beneficiaries of the trust, save for Kenny and Kelly, whom we don't think are beneficiaries of the trust as amendment, none of them had any idea that this was pending. And the delay here was only a matter of a few weeks, but logically there's no difference between delaying 3 weeks or 3 months or 6 months. The point is that at the end of the statute of repose, nobody knew about this, and that creates real problems from a procedural standpoint and from a trust administration standpoint.
I'm going to stop the proceeding for just a second. I'm having a tough time with a cough here. I'm going to go get a cough drop, and I'll be right back. So sorry for the interruption. Once again, I apologize, but you probably didn't want to have to speak over my barking. So with that, I hope it didn't break your train of thought, and go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Let me break your train of thought then. Tell me, in a perfect world, if you're going to commence an action to challenge a trust,
what the parties did here.
Yep.
Tell me what the process is and what has to be done. Can you commence the action in the administration? Can you file a complaint and summons in that? File it separately. Tell me how you view those statutes.
Your Honor, I think that the way it makes most sense for me is if you want to challenge a trust, to file it as a declaratory judgment action. And in Mr. Hickey's argument, he stated that's what this trust challenge was. It was a declaratory judgment action. That's the action that's subject to a statute of limitations. I believe that if you wanted to, if there were matters of the trust that required supervision during the pendency of the declaratory judgment action, you could file a concurrent trust supervision proceeding. I don't even quarrel with the idea that you could file them together in the same piece of paper.
So if you're filing it in the action, you're saying you got to file a complaint or petition in the trust supervision proceeding and file a separate and then serve a separate summons.
I think that if you're going to put them, if you do them separately, if you file a declaratory judgment action, you follow the rules that apply to a declaratory judgment action. If you combine a declaratory judgment action with a trust supervision request or an administrative supervision request, then I don't believe that relieves you of your obligations to comply with the rules of procedure that apply to a declaratory judgment.
So you'd prepare a summons, serve it on the... Who would you serve it on? Who are the defendants?
You'd serve it on the defendants. I believe it's Chapter 21, 24, all interested parties in the subject matter of the declaration. That's paraphrasing the language of the statute, so don't quote me on that. But.
And those are who? Who are the interested parties?
In this instance, I believe it would be the beneficiaries and the trustee. And potentially any creditors, if there were creditors as well. Yeah.
Let me ask a question similar to the one I asked, maybe the same one I asked Mr. Hickey, because it seems like kind of we're getting close to this area. What, in your view, is encompassed or contemplated with the remedy of trust supervision generally, or maybe even here, however you want to answer it?
As I recall your question to Mr. Hickey, it was more about the general nature of what...
Answer that one.
Yeah. So I think it is an administrative convenience that the legislature has created. It allows parties at any point in time to go into court, to have an accounting approved, to have a judge authorize certain actions by a fiduciary that can hopefully avoid disputes relating to the trust administration. I think this court got it right in its Winterstein decision that trust administration is distinct from a challenge to the validity of a trust.
Why would it be superior or different than having, in an instance like this, a freestanding action for declaratory judgment, as you just described? What's different? Why would it be different? How could it be different?
In this case, Your Honor, I don't think there is any difference. If you look at the prayer for relief in the petition filed, all it requested was that the court take supervision and then grant declaratory relief. So I don't think there is a functional distinction in this case.
Except maybe as to how you start the action.
Well, and I don't think there
and
is.
When you start the action, depending upon how we view the arguments, right?
That's the position of the appellant here.
Correct,
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I do agree with one point in the McFarland's opening appellate brief to this court. On page 17, the last paragraph on that page, the McFarlands state that, quote, Chapter 21-22 does not contain any provision governing pleading, close quote. And that statement is correct.
What?
Governing pleading.
Yeah.
And as Justice Salter's questions got at, there's nothing in Chapter 21-22 that specifically provides to the contrary that the rules specifically displaces the rules of civil procedure that apply to actions generally and actions under Chapter 21-22.
Mr. Billion, if the situation had been reversed and the Mr. Jenkins had filed a petition under 21-22 on the provisions of 55-457G as the trustee, and asked for an order confirming that the most recent versions of the trust were valid. Is it your position that he would have then had to serve potential opponents to that request by service of summons?
I would have, yes.
Well, do you think that's required? Not whether you would have, whether it's good practice, but would that have been required had it been initiated in that fashion?
So I believe that if Mr. Jenkins were to file a petition requesting administrative supervision of the trust in its current terms, that yes, you would file, you could file that per the reference in 55457G, file that as a trust administrative matter. But yes, I believe I would have served that with, and I do believe it would be required then to serve that as a civil action. And moreover, if Mr. Jenkins had requested any declaratory relief, that also would have required service of a summons.
Did the court have jurisdiction over this case once the petition was filed under the provisions of 2122, do you think?
No, I don't believe so, because this was a non-judicial trust. I believe the court would have to accept that at a hearing, and the court did not accept it until substantially later, at which point in time there are some ongoing tax issues and other issues that have required court supervision. But that was accepted at a later time. I see I have about 3 minutes left, but if no one else has any further questions, I can conclude a few minutes
early. Nobody's ever chastised for quitting early around here, so if you've had your say, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Billion. All right, Mr. Hickey, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Just a couple of things. I think the court has pointed out the difficulty of the service. Who do you serve? Mr. Billion says all interested parties. When you haven't seen the document, who is an interested party? Clearly, under the other language, under the petition language, it defines who gets notice. But all interested parties? I mean, and what happens if you miss somebody? You know, you don't know about an heir, or you don't know about a creditor. That's the absurdity of the service process. There has to be some mechanism that you can identify people that are interested in the trust administration. And so that's the dilemma that you face. If you have a summons and a complaint, who do you serve? There are no defendants. I mean, in a lawsuit, you know who the driver of the other vehicle was, or you know who breached the contract. It's pretty easy. That's information that you have, that you're available, that you have, so that you can make effective service.
Notwithstanding that, if we accept your argument, do you agree, Mr. Hickey, that we would be allowing two different rules for essentially the same type of action? So in other words, if you're seeking a declaration of the validity of a trust instrument, and you bring this as a freestanding declaratory judgment action, it's a civil action, you commence it by summons and complaint, you figure out who the interested parties, let's say, are, just for this hypothetical. So that requires a service of summons and complaint for a declaration of the validity. You seek the same relief under 2122, but under 2122, you don't have to, under your argument, you don't have to serve a summons and complaint. And the mere filing of the petition suffices. Same relief, same essential action, two different rules. What would explain that?
I think the explanation is that 2122 is specific with respect to trust administration. That sets out the established rules of procedure.
What about the text, filing and setting a hearing says this is the procedure for commencing? What about that text says this is equal to commencement?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
What about the text, file the petition and get a hearing date. I'm paraphrasing now.
Mm-hmm.
What about that text says this is commencing?
Well, there's a difference between supervision and commencement, Your Honor. I think this, if you go on to read the statute, it says at the hearing, the court will assume court supervision. Okay? That is different than commencement.
No,
you're equating supervision with commencement.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about beginning the action. I mean, I don't want to quarrel with you, but I've got that distinction in my mind.
Okay.
What starting the lawsuit, starting the action, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
What about the text, file the petition and get a hearing date equals commencement of the action?
Is an in a civil action?
No, in this one, under 21-22-9.
I think the filing of the petition commences the action.
I know that.
Okay, so I guess I'm not understanding your question. I'm sorry.
Maybe that's the answer. Okay, I'll accept that.
Okay, I apologize.
No, you're fine.
I didn't. I'm sorry. The other thing that I guess I want to point out is that when we received the court's decision, we contacted lawyers in the state of South Dakota to see how do you do trust challenges, and not a one said we file a summons and complaint. We do a summons and complaint in the court supervision. Not a one. I mean, and so this statute came about in 2015, as I understand it, and the court's decision in Winterstein was in 2018. I read the briefs in Winterstein, and if you remember, Your Honor, you were the trial judge. Basically, there the argument was they're saying there were two proceedings. There was the 21-22 proceeding, and there was the 55-4-57 proceeding. And the court basically said no, you know, in footnote 8 said that it at least appears to us that the proper proceeding was to file the petition under 21-22. I mean, if you read the opinion, I mean, they were going down a different track than that we're here today. And I guess now we're back to, are there two procedures? I don't know. But it seems to me that the court doesn't have to go that far, because all it has to look at is the language in Winterstein, the language in 21-22-9, that in the word commence and judicial proceeding. It doesn't say, nowhere does it say you have to commence an action. It talks about a judicial proceeding, which I think we've briefed that well. It talks about the commencement of a judicial proceeding, which we've discussed, and I believe that comports with the requirements of the statute. And the whole purpose of this thing is to give notice, right? And that's what all of those errors got notice. Mr. Jenkins didn't get notice because we didn't know about him as the trustee of the third and fourth amendment. But all of those errors, every single one of them, all of Russell Carver's children, as well as his stepchildren, got actual notice of the fact that we had filed a petition requesting court supervision of that trust. And, you know, obviously, if they wanted to come in and file their objection and say, no, we think that the proper trust is the Third and Fourth Amendment, that's exactly what happens in a probate. I mean, you have all kinds of probates that where there are conflicting wills in terms of undue influence, and that's done by petition. It's not done by commencement of an action, and there is no difference. I mean, I've done a number of will contests, and you file a petition. You file an objection to the probate of the will. And if the other side comes in and says they've got a will that deserves probate, then you have a proceeding that the court ultimately makes a decision. And there shouldn't be a difference between a trust administration and a will contest with respect to how you go about challenging that. Because isn't the whole purpose of this is to get to the truth? I mean, isn't it to try to find out whether the guy was competent and whether the will or the trust was the product of undue influence? I mean, we have struggled with this issue for over 5 years, trying to get to a determination as to whether or not Russell Carver was competent and whether or not these were the product of undue influence. And Every time we turned around, we met with a roadblock. And again, if we hadn't filed anything when we did, Your Honor, they would have waited a year and a day, and they're bulletproof. You can't do anything. And if that's, like I said, all that statute does, that statute of repose, is to reward bad actors or people who are trying to hide things. And we filed, we timely filed, in our view, a petition seeking court supervision, seeking a determination as to the validity of the second, third, and fourth amendment. They had notice. Mr. Jenkins came in and objected. And I believe that's a proper setting for the determination as to whether or not Russell Carver had competency and whether or not that is the product of undue influence.
I asked Mr. Billion about when the court had jurisdiction over the trust, mm-hmm. Under 2122. When did the court, in your view, have jurisdiction, and what's your authority for that?
I believe it has jurisdiction after the hearing, where it assumes court supervision, because that's the way, as I read 21-22-9, it basically talks about that. It says you commence it, notice is given, there's a hearing, and at that hearing the court assumes court supervision. And I'm equating supervision with jurisdiction, Your Honor.
How can the court not have jurisdiction after something's been commenced?
How can it not have?
Yeah.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the court always has jurisdiction to determine if it has jurisdiction. And if the action is commenced, I believe it does have jurisdiction, but supervision doesn't start until after that hearing. If I'm correct in equating supervision with jurisdiction. And maybe that's not a correct categorization, but that's what I, under the question that you asked,
yeah,
that's what
I'm
assuming.
Just asking, when does the court have jurisdiction over this matter?
Oh, I think it had jurisdiction from the day one, soon as it's filed.
What's your authority for that in terms of the same statutes you've cited, in terms of from the date of the filing of the petition?
Well, because that's the date that the action was commenced. The court has jurisdiction from the point that the action is commenced.
So you rely on those statutes you've already cited.
Right, because it's a judicial proceeding.
Your time has expired.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.